Maine. A place where you can find breathtaking scenery from sandy beaches, ice-capped mountains, and pristine lakes. A place you can enjoy a delicious lobster while sipping on one of Maine's finest craft brews and saving room for a blueberry pie. But the one thing many people may not know about Maine is the artistry and craftsmanship that comes with the culture of this beautiful state. From the Industrial Revolution to now, Maine has continued to build its economy through makers, and there are hundreds of them. Maine has makers that can handcraft a high-quality piece of wood furniture where the joinery fits like a glove. Sew a skirt made with plant-based fabric with a New England Maine machine that was invented in 1881. Make a mean mustard through a cold grind process made in the same mill since 1900, and much more. Join me for a journey through the lives of makers from across Maine to hear how they get down with their craft. I'm Christian Vermeulen, and this is Makers of Maine. This episode is brought to you by Hobson & Company, CPAs that serve small businesses across the state of Maine. The firm provides outstanding service to their clients because of their dedication to three underlying principles of professionalism, responsiveness, and quality. I remember talking to a local small business about CPAs in the area, and Hobson & Company was the first that came to mind. Adam Hobson, the owner and founder of the firm, treats his staff and clients like family. His firm consists of five CPAs, and his wife also works for the firm as well, so it's definitely a family-run business. If you're in search of a CPA that is attentive to your financial and tax needs, Hobson & Co. is the way to go. Now back to our Makers of Maine interview. According to the Abbey Museum, the Kowabunakiaik used Maine as a central meeting place to trade, hunt, and fish with one another during the summers. One summer, visitors arrived that would change these Native Americans' lives forever. They chose to lean in and incorporate these new teachings to keep their traditions alive for future generations. One tradition I learned so much about from a 13th generation Passamaquoddy basket weaver and artist, Gabriel Frey. Gabriel specializes in black ash utility and fancy packs, purses, and much more. From harvesting a tree to striking the tree to break up the fibers that will give you a raw piece of ash, to using a gauge when splitting pieces of ash, to hand weaving the pieces together, Gabe does it all. This process is quite lengthy, yet it is beautiful. It is a process that involves natural elements, different colors of ash put together in an art form that can be used for its purpose. Back in time, it was used for survival, for collecting and storing food. And now it is an eye-catching handbag that is truly one of a kind. Gabe has done a fabulous job in finding the balance between utility and fancy, which I never knew there were two different art forms when it came to basket weaving. His craft comes so naturally to him as he can sit at a campfire surrounded by the raw material that goes into all of his pieces. I learned about the history of basket weaving, his particular craft, and the process behind it, and how him and his wife are coming out with a children's book. We start off the conversation talking about Maine craft and then right into his story. I think you're going to enjoy Gabe's story. Now, let's talk craft, basket weaving, with Gabriel Frey.
We do. We have such a rich craft tradition here that I think it's sort of like one of the sort of like characteristics of Mainers is this ability to do more with less. Like just throughout, like, you know, one sort of like, I don't know if you've been up there, but there's a museum up in the county of farm inventions and repurposed things that are like, you know, maybe it's like part of a washing machine that then turns into like built into a baler of some kind, like just rigged up things that Mainers have made. It's this sort of like this other sort of side tradition. Up in the county, I can't remember what town it's in, but yeah, it's I'm of course I'm gonna space in the name. Yeah, I think it's something like the Farm Museum or something like that, where yeah, it's filled with the most amazing things that are sort of like, you know, it's part of the characteristic of Mainers. Sort of like,
yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. I love it. I'm gonna definitely look that up. It's just so interesting that I'm discovering like schools and organizations that focus on craft and like helping kids go and learn that. Like, I feel like that's a skill that's so like they're missing out on because like screen time is just so like priority right now.
Yeah.
And I get it. We're in a virtual world. I understand from a school perspective and stuff, but like, yeah, I really do enjoy that Maine has that. And there's multiple ways of doing it. It's not just one school.
No, there's tons. There's,
yeah.
Wabanaki Reach is a program through the university or a university adjacent that is basically like getting Indigenous youth into science. But the way that they do it are through these traditional sort of ways of like, I did a camp one summer where we took a youth group out into an ash stand, cut down a tree, processed it. So they're seeing not only the science of like the biology of the area and the ecology and everything, but also this tradition that's been passed down. So right. That's sort of like that way of exploring the natural world through craft, and especially craft in Maine, because there are so many different branches of it. It's pretty amazing.
Oh yeah. There's so many, like, you know, over the summer I went and saw glass being blown for the first time. People are like, you haven't seen that yet? And I was like, no, like, I have not. Like, you know, it's just sounded like a question being like, really? Like, you haven't? Like, I'm from Maryland. Like, I, you know, there, I would say there are makers there, but not to the scale like it is here. And I know there's some hidden gems out there throughout the nation, such as, you know, what Anthony Bourdain, you know, had said in his Raw Craft show. Like, I didn't know who those makers were. Even that knife maker that was on Raw Craft, I was like, who is that guy? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, I feel like there's just a lot more to unfold here in the state. There's a lot more makers that are going to be a part of this project. And so I can't wait to learn more about it. And, but so this leads me into my, you know, first question is, what is your craft and what inspired you to start it?
My craft, black ash basket making, specifically black ash utility baskets. So I'm a 13th generation basket maker. So it goes back in my family. I say 13 generations, but really it's we as a people have been doing this for generations and generations and generations. The specific style that I do, utility, is more of sort of gets into how we lived pre-European contact, if that makes sense. So like one of the traditional sort of objects that you see that's sort of almost ubiquitous with the Maine outdoors is like the pack basket, right? It's like flat and it has, you know, that shape was actually designed to fit in the hull of a canoe. Now, prior to European contact, all of our highways were rivers. And so every family had a birch bark canoe and you had to transport your stuff, whether it was like what you were harvesting or just your goods, your everything else.
Right. Right. That makes sense.
So that tradition was sort of carried through. And the short version of the long history is that through the sort of like Industrial Revolution and all of that, where the fisheries were exploding on the coast and, you know, agriculture was getting huge up north, the Indigenous communities were adjacent to all of that. And so our craft shifted to what was around us. So the economy of basket making was like in the farmlands. You see like what is incredibly recognizable up north is the potato basket, right? That's a Wabanaki piece of art, but it was used in the farm fields, right? And then towards the coast, you have the scale baskets, which were used in the fisheries. And that was something where you would have tribal members pounding ash. You would have other people processing that ash, and you would have other people weaving that ash. And so it was this cottage industry within the community. So it was always like this expression of culture, because part of what happens when you're making baskets with other community members, there are stories being passed down. you're using the language, you're not reliant on handouts from the federal government, which was sort of like part of that historical system of attempted erasure. So there are so many components built into the tradition of basket making that is both like incredibly culturally important, but also economically as well. And there was, you know, for the longest time, there was this like symbiotic relationship with the communities that surrounded indigenous communities. And then with the sort of introduction of plastic and barrels and all of this other stuff that inevitably sort of like turned that economy around, there wasn't the market, so there was less makers. There were still the fancy basket makers, which that really sort of exploded during the Rusticator era, when there was like, you know, the Victorians were coming over and like wanting to see the wild, you know, outback. And so then our craft, what we, you know, because we always made all sizes of baskets, but then they started to become much more intricate, much more detailed. And there'd be like little things that were like points on the basket, you know, things to make them much more delicate, but also easy to transport. So somebody could come to Maine and be like, oh, a piece of this rustic environment.
Right.
And so that carried through up into the 60s and 70s and 80s. A lot of the elders who had grown up making baskets, there was, it just wasn't the economy. It was more beneficial to leave the reservation, to leave the tribe, to seek higher education and benefit the tribe that way. So in the early 90s, a couple of basket makers got together and formed the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance. And this was a nonprofit. Basically, they got funding to pair master basket makers with youth that wanted to learn. And then coupled with they established market sales, like areas where you could go and sell what you've made. And then these basket shows really created or rejuvenated the tradition of Wabanaki basketry. So you went from like 50 basket makers in the entire sort of like Wabanaki Confederacy to upwards of 300 that were practicing and doing it. So actually like restoring the craft. The major difference that occurred was creating these markets actually allowed people to connect with a basket maker as an individual artist, rather than these piecemeal, you know, sort of like selling them for 5 cents, because that's what was really like back in the 60s and 70s. They were like, you just make as many as you can. And and the same amount of work went into it. That's the crazy part. I remember some of my wife's research, she was like looking at this old footage from the people who would eventually become the Wabanaki Basket Makers board. But back then, they were just kids in their 20s and 30s collectively talking about raising the price of a potato basket to $5 or $8. And if they raised it to $8, would that like shut down the market? So, I mean, just to think about that, like, it's crazy. So,
that is pretty nuts.
Yeah. So
I would like to see like, wow. Yeah. I mean, how big are these potato baskets? How long does it take to make one of these?
Well, it depends. I mean, they're usually like, you know, a good foot across, you know, they can hold like a 5 pounds of potatoes. Right. So it's, you know, I guess being from Maryland, you probably don't know that metric. I got about 5 pounds of potatoes. Yeah, that makes sense. That's a good size. So yeah, it's like a bag of potatoes, right? How much that can hold.
Right.
With the sort of like explosion of these markets, there's more people making baskets. The money was really in fancy baskets because you can use less material. Right. There's more time that goes into it. But overall, you can get way more money because they're looked at as a piece of art. I grew up around basket making. So it was just one of those things that, like, when you grow up around something, it's just normal. It's just always there. You don't necessarily recognize the significance, I guess. Like, it's that sort of like, when a miracle becomes common, right? It's sort of like, oh yeah, that's, you know, just something I see all the time.
Right.
And it wasn't until I was around 18 and my grandfather was diagnosed with emphysema. And I kind of looked around and saw that there was a lot of this tradition that was being passed down, but he raised 13 kids fishing, doing carpentry and making baskets. As a kid, he would tell me that if I could make a basket, I would never go hungry. Like, and that's sort of like, you know, oh yeah, you pass on the craft or whatever. But for him, that was a truth. Like, the difference between starvation of 12 kids was like whether he could do this, because you can literally just walk out in the woods, cut down a tree, and there's wealth.
Right.
And so that's sort of him getting sick. Before that, he was just sort of like invincible. He's always going to be there. You know, it's like there's no pressure. But then that sort of like put the, I need to actually pick this up because nobody else is. And so I went and spent time just learning the process from him.
Wow. That's, and I know you had graciously sent me one of your baskets that you made with your grandfather, correct?
Yeah. So that's his traditional. So he made that form, the mold. It's buried back here. He made that mold back in the 60s. And then, so I still make pack baskets on that mold.
Do you find that the traditional skills that you were taught by your grandfather, are they still kind of a part of your processes when going and crafting your art, your custom work, or have you innovated those practices over the years?
So it's yes to both of those questions, because the process, it's been innovated over the years, but the original way that my grandfather taught me was the result of thousands of years of refining this process to its best way. It's not the easiest way, which I think as Americans, we're sort of like addicted to finding the easier path. But sometimes the harder path produces the best product, right? So there are ways to like break down the tree differently to get those splints to make the basket. But when you process it from the tree, like the log itself, if the tree actually is growing in a spiral, those splints will come off the way that it was grown. And so there you have the sort of the actual incorporated fibers that the tree produced disintegrated from the tree. And then you have this like the strongest possible version of that fiber. So in that sense, I have not innovated that at all. I'm doing this sort of like traditional form. On the other hand, I've taken sort of like the pack basket, which is sort of like a very rustic, my grandfather was a strict utilitarian. There was no like room for embellishment at all. And when I started doing this, I first started by just, instead of just rough cutting a piece of wood and putting it on the hoop for that's the frame of the top of the basket, I would spend more time carving it down, rounding it out, sanding it, which he thought was hilarious. And then even like doing like a linseed oil on it, it just made it look more finished, I think. And then started incorporating other weaves into the basket. And so, yeah, there's sort of like all of these different things. And that's like taking the traditional form, but I think it's probably 10 years ago, I made a small, like a pack basket, but it was tiny. And then just put a leather strap on it. And I was like, hey, it's a purse. Sort of like as a, you know, whatever. And it immediately sold. I was like, well, crap. You know, sort of like how you figure out pricing is like, if it sells like just like that, then you've obviously priced it way too low.
Right.
And so, and then I did another one. I got a little better at leather work and eventually just sort of like kept evolving that process until like, you know, doing a leather liner inside, making custom fabric to go in the liner, it's like inside the pocket, there's Jeez. Like a designed fabric inside of that.
Right.
And then, yeah, so today, like, this is one of my sort of like high-end purses, which it's a adaptation of a herringbone weave on the front. And that's actually just a split standard. So the standards are the ones that go up and down. And
okay.
So the basket itself is still, it's the same exact bottom that you would find in any other pack basket, but the front six I've split into from a half inch. I split it down to 3/16 and then created that weave. And then it's dyed with madder root and indigo. And so
it's beautiful.
That's been, and then the leather work on top. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah, I can.
So that's a traditional Wabanaki double curve design. That's sort of like what we have as our graphic. Traditionally, that would have been like etched in birch bark.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So you mentioned that there are a variety of different weaves. Can you kind of take the audience like a step back into like what those entail? Because I know standard, like I get that, but like what other weaves are there? I would love to hear.
Well, I mean, there's not a huge sort of like variety. It basically gets into utility. So like in a potato basket, it's most potato baskets, I'll say. It's a stack weave. So you do one row and then you do the next row and it's a separate piece, right? With most pack baskets, it's a spiral weave. So in order to reduce waste, you take that one middle standard and then split it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that makes the basket have an odd number, right? So then that allows you to just keep going around and around and around, because if it has an even number, then you're going to stagger at some point.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so you either basically do a staggered weave, which is like probably if you can, when you interview Sarah, you can look inside of one of her baskets. And usually what happens is they'll put the stagger on the inside. So you don't see it from the outside, but it overlaps. And then if you're paying attention, you always do your stagger next to the stagger before. So it creates, when you look inside the basket, it creates this spiral that comes up. That's almost entirely imperceptible from the outside of the basket. But that's another way to sort of like reduce waste. So with this one, this, I guess that split standard would be the stagger. But that allows you to not, like, if you go 3/4 of the way around a basket and you have like another piece that's not going to go around the basket all the way, that piece becomes waste, right?
Right.
And then the herringbone weave, that, so like that is just in its simplest form, it's just over, over, under, under, right? If that makes sense, you know, if your listeners are craft people. So like you can take that basic principle, that sort of like that math, and you can do all kinds of stuff with it. So like I say by an adaptation, because like I've created a diamond pattern on this by doing that over, over, under, under, and then just switching it at a certain point. But most of the time I do like a chevron, like on this one, which is just, you know, mirroring the other side.
Right.
So yeah. And the utility of the weave that you use would oftentimes depend on the style of basket or the unique basket that you're making. I do a market basket, which because of the size of the basket, the standard or the weavers are too big to do the sort of skip one, because it's basically like you would definitely see it, right? It's sort of like it becomes super obvious. Yeah. And then it's also like if it's also too small to do that split standard, because on a market basket it has a wide opening, and so if you have that split standard, by the time you get to the top, it creates this sort of like cattywampus sort of looking shape to the binding. I don't know if I'm throwing too much jargon in there.
No, this is great. It's nice to learn sort of like the language behind like the basket weaving process, and you know, you've definitely, you know, trimmed it down to where I can definitely understand it. And it's great that I can like see this through the camera, because my listeners unfortunately can't, but it's okay. We know we'll take some right. photos to better understand your process. So tell me a little bit more about sort of when you're going through the process of making a product, whether it be, it sounds like you do a lot of custom, correct? Like you're just more focused on the art rather than the utilitarian piece, right? Or do you still touch them both?
Well, yeah, again, I would say it's yes to both, because so I feel like a strict utilitarian is trapped in one sort of time, right? And so again, like when I started doing these purses, they're still utility baskets. The utility has changed. So like a fancy basket, its function, its utility is to be beautiful. It's not to be used. Right. It's to be admired. So everything about it, its function is to just like be gorgeous. My baskets are meant to be used, right? So everything that I do is toward the function, but then also part of that function is also to be beautiful, to sort of like express, I guess, the complexity of Wabanaki culture, which is like sort of that, like there is so much beauty there and there's so much utility there.
Right. It's like you hit on both, like you just balance it out. Cause I feel like now and like, you know, today's world, it's like people are looking for utility and looking for, you know, beautiful work. So it's nice that you're representing both. And so when you go about utilizing certain weaving techniques and kind of learning about the usage of how this piece is going to be used, like for instance, like, you know, the beautiful pack that you sent me, I was like, hey, I'm going dog sledding and I'm probably going to be carrying, you know, quite a bit of cargo because, you know, I want to best showcase your work. And so is there a certain technique you have in mind to kind of keep that weight in mind, like how much cargo you can put in there?
Yeah. So yeah, that goes like backing way up to when I first go harvest a tree, there are qualities that you look at for a fancy basket, and there are qualities that you look at for a utility basket. And so generally, the refinement of the material is going to be less when you're making a utility basket because you want it to be thicker. And I can actually sort of like, I don't know how familiar you are with the entire process.
I'm familiar with just reading on it, you know, doing a little research, but I would love to hear your perspective as well. Like to hear more about the process would be lovely.
Okay. So beginning with tree selection, right? You basically like it's wetland species, so you're generally going into some very remote areas. And then you're looking for straightest, most uninterrupted tree. So like an interruption would be like branches or knots or things like that. That basically gets into like the quality of the material, and then the quality of the material based on what you're looking for. So if somebody ordered a pack basket, I'm going to be looking for thicker material. And the thickness is how much nutrients and water that tree got over the course of several years. The growth ring itself right. will be thicker. And so after I've harvested the log, you take, and it's usually around 8 to 10 inches and about 6 to 8 feet long. And you basically have to pound with the blunt edge of an axe the entire tree. So every square inch, if you miss one spot, those fibers remain fused. And so what the striking does, wow. it breaks the layer in between the growth ring, which is, it's considered the fast growth. So like mm-hmm. the seasonality of the tree, because ash is a ring porous tree, the delineation between the seasons is extremely stark. So there's like, it'll be this really, really dense layer and then almost a spongy layer, which is that fast growth. That's mm-hmm. where the tree is like springing into life. Right. And so the striking is basically compressing the water in between the growth rings in that spongy layer and then breaking those fibers. And so you can literally just peel off the year's growth ring. And so that is like your raw material, which we see here. So like this is a raw piece of ash that is just off the tree, right? And then this is generally how it's stored. We just coil it up and have it laying around. And so after you have that, the amazing quality of this tree is that you can take that densely packed cellular structure and score it, just cut into it with a knife, and then peel it. And so you can peel that piece in half. And then depending on the quality of the material, you can peel that, you can split that ash up to 7 times. So you get incredibly strong, incredibly thin material.
Jeez. And you just do that with an axe, or is there other tools that you use in order to go and slice this?
Oh yeah, no. So there's all kinds of, like, no. So the axe is just the removing from gotcha. The tree.
Yeah.
Right. And then, mm-hmm. yeah. And then, I've got a myriad of knives for different purposes. Like, this is my shaving knife. It's very, very sharp, but it has this nice sort of like rounded blade to it. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't cut into the material. So it's literally, so what I mean by shaving is like when you have the raw piece, there's that fiber that was pounded is mm-hmm. still on the piece. So then you literally just shave that off. I have a piece of leather that I'll put on my knee and just scrape over the piece of ash.
Wow.
And then most of the carving that I do is literally just with a utility razor. But then there's like this is actually an old Dexter Shoe Company knife. So this was like the size of a giant knife, but it's probably from the early 1900s and has wow. been sharpened to the point of like being a pick.
Right.
And so that's just for like moving splints around and getting into specific areas. And then this is for, this is another shaving knife for larger pieces.
Wow.
So there's lots of different sort of tools for different aspects.
Yeah, I can see that. There's a lot that goes into it. Have those tools been carried down like through generations? Like how did they do it, back in time? Like did they make their own knives? Like how did they do that?
Yeah, yeah. The introduction of steel was definitely like a major shifting point in the history part.
Right.
The axe that my grandfather used for pounding was actually from the 1700s, and that had been
wow.
passed down. And then the other thing that is passed down are, these are called gauges.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, basically it's a handle with a set of blades, a specific width apart. So this is a eighth inch. And so that is how you get this specific width. So once you have that split to your desired sort of whatever thinness you want, if you're making fancy baskets, you're going to want it really, really thin. If you want utility baskets, it's going to be a little bit thicker. And then so that these tools come in all sizes. So like it's a 3/4. And traditionally they were very intricately carved.
Yeah, I could see that. They're like, they're beautiful. Man.
And so those are the types of tools that you actually, you can't really buy them because they're like, they are something you have to either make them yourself or go to another artisan who makes them.
Wow. Wow. Oh my goodness. That's so interesting to learn more about the tools that go into it and just the processes. And so after you go and, you know, carve out, you know, slice, like how many, by the way, kind of off topic, but how many of those, what's the term, like the coiled bark, really, like is it called shavings? Like what, is there a term for that? Like
how so many? So when you have this form, this is a splint.
A splint. Okay. So how many splints do you get out of that one log? I guess it depends, right? So like an average number. Yeah.
There's no. So what happens is like because you're dealing with a tree that grows in nature and it's not consistent over the course of several years.
Right.
What I do is when I'm taking everything off, I categorize it. So number one, you'll get this really white material, which is like it's like the splints are like paper white. That is considered like the highest grade material because that's from like the living part of the tree. So that's like it's most sort of like pristine. And then as you get closer to the heartwood, it starts to darken. And then some basket makers say it's more brittle. I haven't found that. I think it's just sort of the discoloration is a little bit more dull. And so I'll categorize it basically by thickness and color. So like even within that sort of sapwood, there'll be different thicknesses and you can sort of go, well, this piece, if it's an eighth of an inch thick, you can split that down 5 times and then you have that set. And if you can do that enough, then you can organize that.
Yeah.
So that's really sort of like how that gets organized. How much depends on the quality, what you're making. So I always think about it in terms of pack baskets. You could probably get 12 pack baskets out of a log. That makes sense. Wow.
That's a lot.
So
how often do you go out and harvest, you know, the logs? Like what's the appropriate like timing? Do you just go out there when you get a custom order and you're like, okay, it's time to do this? Or like
what do you
typically do?
I harvest ahead. I generally go out twice a year. And that is a whole bunch of factors in that. If I find a stand that has really quality material, I'll generally go out like once or twice a year. And then just sort of like the idea is to process as much as you can so that you don't have to continuously go out and, you know, like,
right,
do that every time, because there's even the stewardship component to how you harvest. Like I may find a stand that has perfect material, but the growth rate of the trees are sort of like they're all a little slightly immature. So then you would do selective cutting to basically like open up the canopy for select trees so that they can grow and, you know, basically produce more ash.
Right.
And really like aside from the threat of EAB, the emerald ash borer, it's best, like that's always been the philosophy, is it's best to store a tree in an ash stand growing.
Yeah, but it's so interesting. So how do you know the age of the tree? Like, can you just look at it and just like tell, like did it, that skill kind of, did you learn that over time?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Cause you can tell by the size of a tree, like that one, if you can see that it's so like the bark will tell you a lot about the health of the tree. Mm-hmm. And then the size of the tree, you can basically be like, you're not going to get enough material out of that. But right. in 12 to 15 years, you'll get a whole lot of material out of that.
Right.
So it's best to be like, I know where that is. I know that it's good quality. I'm just going to leave it.
Right. Now that's so interesting. And from, I know you mentioned earlier that you like waste, correct? So it's like, you don't want to be wasteful in terms of how you go about crafting your pieces and such. And I find that very interesting because, you know, you're using natural elements to go and make, you know, your products. And, you know, I know, especially right now, you know, with climate change and, you know, sustainability factors and just the environment, I'm sure that's very important to you and your community. So how do you keep that in mind? Like, you know, what is the definition of wasteful when it comes to making these baskets? And like, how do you go about reducing that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because like in terms of how much of the tree, the actual full tree we use, mm-hmm. we don't use a whole lot. Like
yeah.
2/3 of the tree goes to waste
right.
or back into the earth. I mean, I guess it's the idea of like waste, but right. when you're dealing with the material that you're getting out of that log, that's kind of like one of the reasons I started doing the smaller purses, because I have, I'm not going to show you over there, but that's I have fine. Bins and bins of, quote unquote scraps
right.
from the larger baskets, because there are, when you're making, a pack basket that, so if I'm dealing with a 6-foot log, that mm-hmm. 6 feet isn't going to go all the way around. So you end up having this like waste piece,
right.
which you can't use in another pack basket because it's only 2 feet long,
right.
but you can split that up and make a 6-inch basket or a, you
right.
know, and so in that sense, the smaller baskets help reduce the waste as well, but then yeah. also how you create, the basket itself, like the hoop, the frame of the basket
mm-hmm.
and the handle, that's all from the heartwood. So like once you've taken off as much as you can,
mm-hmm.
the heart is still there,
right.
Which then you can carve into the different components. So like with this one, that handle, that's all from what would be considered the waste part of the tree. And then this hoop as well. There's a mm-hmm. hoop on the inside and a hoop on the outside.
Hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. And then when you started using other fabrics like leather and just, you know, more into the interior of your pieces, where do you source them? Like, how did you go about, you know, finding those? Because I'm sure that was definitely a journey in discovering, you know, what exactly you were looking for in terms of fabrics.
When I first started, I actually got a batch of leather from a friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, we've got this excess stuff. And I had been like toying around with the idea of incorporating leather into a basket, but it never ideas never really manifest unless there's like a need and a purpose. So they had this leather and they were like, in exchange for this leather, make me a basket and put a leather liner in it. And I'm like, that's mm-hmm. great. That's a perfect excuse to do it.
Right.
And so I started doing that. And then come to find out, we have this incredible tannery in Heartland, Maine, mm-hmm. which is only like 45 minutes away from me.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Which is like, it's incredible. Like the first time I went there, I was like, this isn't real. Like,
yeah.
you're like, because there's obviously this major cost component to working with leather, right? It's
right.
it's not cheap.
Definitely not.
But then you think about sort of the environmental impact and all of these other things of like, you know, transporting it. If I'm going to like, because I also do work with Italian leather. And
nice.
So that comes with a giant carbon footprint.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the stuff that I use is locally sourced. It's from Heartland. Mm-hmm. And which is like, every time I go in there, I have like a $200 budget ish. Mm-hmm. And I usually spend $700 to $1,000.
Oh my goodness.
Just because I'm like, oh yeah, you want this project would be great. And so like, right. As you start going through all of these different things. And so that in and of itself has created these other sort of like, these other interesting projects and thinking about like what you could do to incorporate something into something else. And, you know,
Right. And so I know you mentioned earlier the pack you showed me has a design on it, and it's sort of like, can you explain to me like what is the kind of the history behind that marking, and do you include that on every single one of your pieces, or is it just like those who asked for it?
Oh yeah, that is really like that is the artistic component. The only time that I've actually had somebody say make this like this, it wasn't even that. It was I like dandelions and springtime. So and then you just have to go, all right, well, let me try to figure that out. And so doing custom orders for people, there's never a literal this is what I want.
Right.
There have been like I like rustic things and harvesting in the woods. And then you go, okay, let's figure that out. Like this one, this pack basket, the guy said he likes to travel and he brings everything that he would need for a gourmet lunch with him.
Hmm.
And then that's how I made that. So it's like, I want to carry it like a suitcase, but I also want to be able to have it on my back. And it needs to be big enough to carry a coffee maker and this. So all of these different things. So it's more about like the utility. And if they're ordering a basket from me, there's generally already a sense that they want something to also be very beautiful.
Right.
So there's that component. This specifically, this symbol is from the Mi'kmaq tribe. And that is a marriage symbol. I don't know if you can see it's two faces, masculine and feminine, sort of coming together. Most of the time, the double curved designs are a representation of what you would find in nature and balance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This one is specifically asymmetrical to show that there are, it's perfectly balanced and it's totally connected, but there are two distinct separate halves.
Hmm. That's so interesting.
And so, and then that sort of theme is also why the color is this way. So you have the madder root, which is this bright sort of red color, and then the indigo, which is this sort of deep saturated blue. And separately, they're very beautiful. But then when you overlap them, both of the colors like pop out.
Right.
So it's that same sort of like integration of separate opposite things that actually make the other better.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. I love, it's crazy to me. Like I'm in awe because there's just so much inspiration behind each of your pieces. Like there's a story. Like would you say that every piece is just, it's different? There's not going to be like one of the same, because I'm sure like, you know, every piece of, you know, wood that, you know, comes out of it, like you're telling me like there's like different colors and, you know, what have you. And then also at the same time, it's like, you know, the symbolism behind it. And, you know, I'm sure. Yeah. It's just crazy. I'm learning so much from this. I'm fascinated.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Because they're like, even if I made the same exact basket, because I do work on molds, these are like the form that I make the basket on. But to your point, even if I'm not using color, the material itself is going to be different.
Right.
And I'm also working with natural dyes. Man. And so you can't create that same color over again. You can do your best and get an approximation. But I've never made the same basket twice.
Wow.
Even if I'm working in the same color range, you can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is sort of like, also something that I really love about it is that it takes a certain amount of pressure off, because ultimately whatever the basket wants to be is going to manifest
right
one way or another.
Yeah.
And so all you have to do is sort of like be listening and be present and then it's sort of like, yeah, comes together.
Yeah. What has been the most fun piece you've worked on? Tell me sort of an example of one that comes to mind.
The one basket that always sticks in my mind, which I never meant to sell, and I did, and it's the only basket I actually regret selling. My brother and I took a trip to Western Maine, to the tribal territory out in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And generally you spend the vast majority of your time looking for the ash.
Right.
And then you harvest it. And so we had 3 days, I think, and we went out there. We actually got there early. On the first day, we stumbled upon this ash stand that was maybe 2 miles long, which is incredibly long for an ash stand.
Yeah.
It's usually a big ash stand is like the size of a football field. And we basically harvested the material that day. And then that night, we pounded the log out in the woods and then processed it, like shaved it, gauged it. And I made a basket by the campfire while we're like cooking steaks. and it was just this really gorgeous shape. It's sort of like freeform shape. It was like an oversized market basket.
Wow.
But yeah, I think that was probably the most fun I've had making a basket and the result as well.
Yeah.
Because of like, yeah, that like connection of like creating this piece of art right next to where you took it from a standing tree.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, to able to do that skill where you don't have to be like in a studio setting where you could just do it like next to a campfire, that's really cool. I never would have thought of folks doing that. And, you know, but, you know, then again, like when you go back in, you know, history, I guess they were doing that, you know, out in the woods, and that was just, that's what they had to do to survive. They had to, you know, build these packs and, you know, put food in them. And it's just, it's so amazing that you're keeping that tradition alive and there's a whole alliance behind it. And, so how many basket weavers are here in Maine that you know of? Like how many?
Wabanaki specifically?
Yeah.
well, so there's two parts to that question. Because basket makers, there's countless numbers, because most everybody in Wabanaki home has had connection with it, has done it. How many people who are making baskets and selling them is a smaller number. So that, you know, there's probably a few hundred.
Oh, wow.
But there's a lot more who know how to do it and just do something else.
Right.
My mother has a weaving circle with some of the tribal elders where they'll all pitch in and buy a log from somebody and then pay a youth to pound it. And then they'll, you know, get together and tell stories and make baskets.
So it sounds like it's more of a communal activity where you get together with folks that, that do it too, or you can sit around and like talk and do storytelling. And I mean, was it like that back in time when your grandfather was doing it? Was it just something that wasn't a job? Mm-hmm. It was more of like a hobby. It was more of just something that it was enjoyable, it seemed like.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was always so interesting to think of it as like a job, because it's both of those. It's a way of obviously like earning an income in, and keeping your family afloat.
Yeah.
But it is also a way of maintaining cultural resilience. So you're teaching this method of craft. You're sharing stories. Mm-hmm. A lot of our spiritual teachings, our cultural teachings are all derived from that oral tradition.
Right.
The tradition of telling stories. Mm-hmm. During the wintertime, that was like the storytelling time. And people would be getting together and making baskets. You know, there are stories of Micmac from Nova Scotia basically spending the entire winter making baskets, and then they would use the islands, they would canoe from Nova Scotia down to Boston, going from island to island to sell their baskets.
Oh my goodness.
So and so, yeah, it was always this communal sort of thing. From like, you know, like Bar Island, the island down in Bar Harbor that's like right off the town, that used to have a huge indigenous encampment there in the summertime where they would go, they would make baskets and sell them to tourists.
Wow. That's fascinating. So, I mean, it sounds like it's definitely a communal activity, yet it's something that you just have to keep doing because, you know, it keeps your family afloat. It brings in money. And I can't wait to go and attend one of these markets where they're being sold, because I'm sure every weaver that's there, basket weaver that's there, just do things differently. And, and it's their own art form. So I'm excited to learn more. And so where can folks go to learn more about where these market events are? Is there a website?
The Hudson Museum has some information on their website. The Abbey Museum has a lot of educational tools on their website. And they have they have packets for schools and everything like that. It's been difficult this past year because like that is also where people get together from the different communities.
Yeah.
And we've had the shows, they've just been virtual, which is a whole other experience because you're like, instead of doing this in front of people and having this sort of like call and response conversation, you're just sort of like sitting in front of a computer or a screen and talking into the void and sort of like being like, all right, well, that's that.
So what brought you and your wife to Orono? I know you guys are from various places in Maine and aren't originally from Orono. So tell me, why Orono?
We're in Orono because she is finishing up her PhD.
Wow. So, good for her.
Yeah.
That's awesome. My goodness. She must be just working so hard. PhDs is like one tough job.
Yeah. Well, that's like, so she's finishing up her PhD. We have two kids, which one of the silver linings has actually been, I've been able to be home more with them to help her as well.
Yeah.
But then she's also in the middle of all of this, started a consulting firm and has been doing Wabanaki engagement, like driving Wabanaki engagement with the federal government.
Wow, that's awesome.
And she's been working on a Indigenous land trust project as well.
Oh my goodness. Like, I need to interview her too. My goodness, that's amazing. Wow, I had no idea. Wow, that's great. I love hearing about that.
She's been doing a lot of sort of like what she calls mobilizing Indigenous knowledge. So like basically taking traditional ecological knowledge and applying it to modern day science. So like one of her recent projects was to do a habitat suitability model for sweetgrass harvesting. So like a sustainability model for the federal government. And then part of that, there was a children's book publisher that was like, this is fascinating research. Do you have any children's stories about this? And so that led to us writing a children's book about traditional ecological knowledge and sort of like, and that sort of like oral tradition, which that's coming out in August.
No way. So like, oh my gosh. Yeah. What's the book called?
The First Blade of Sweetgrass.
Oh, wow.
So like within the culture, teachings are passed on orally, right, from generation to generation. And so like one of the teachings is, if you never pick the first blade of sweetgrass, you'll never pick the last. And so that philosophy sort of applies to everything. If you don't just take everything, you'll always have more, because sort of like that, you know, thinking in terms of like seven generations.
That is such an interesting concept. Thank you so much for sharing that. I can't wait to see this children's book and talk to you and your wife a little bit more about this. So I'm hoping that I can interview you guys again a little later this year when your book launch is coming up, which I understand is in the fall.
So why stay in Maine? Why is it important to you? Why is it important to your craft? I always end this question with every interview that I do, because I find that Maine, and I'm learning still, you know, about Maine since I've only been here for 3 years, but I find that the community, it's just a lot of people lean in and they help each other out. And I'm sure you can relate to that too, since you have a whole alliance of basket weavers. So tell me, you know, tell me about your life in Maine and how you've been appreciating it and you've grown to love it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, my family has always been here. So even, you know, even the Mainers who are five generations back are still guests of the Wabanaki. This is traditional Wabanaki territory. I guess the why is that it's my ancestral lands, and that connection it's not just on a physical level, it's a spiritual level. Mm-hmm. And so being in a place where your people have been and thrived for thousands and thousands of years has a certain responsibility that comes with it. And so even the craft itself is a way to get people who come to Maine to be able to utilize and experience a piece of not only Maine, but traditional Wabanaki territory.
Right.
Because that actually takes that tree that grew here, that grew in this soil, creates this piece of art that will hopefully be used in somebody's day-to-day life, wherever they are.
Thank you for tuning into Makers of Maine. And thank you to Gabriel Frey for being on the podcast. If you'd like to see visuals of his wonderful craft and pieces, please follow along Makers of Maine on Instagram and Facebook. I also want to give a shout out to Brendan Bullock, who took these lovely photos. He will be featured on my Makers Behind the Lens series real soon. If you enjoyed this episode and others on this podcast, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Facebook. Now for our featured musician is Hawk Henrys. Hawk started playing and making flutes about 31 years ago. He has played at well-known festivals, including the New Orleans Jazz Festival, and composed music to play with the London Mozart Players in England. He moved to Maine 34 years ago. Here's a song, Song to Eagle with Spots. I will link his information in the notes section of this podcast. Thank you all again, and stay safe and healthy.